Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, alternatives to policing, putting the power and money back into our communities and schools. Our guests include Amber Yang, who's a restorative justice and wellness coordinator, and also Phoebe Smith, a veteran teacher who is also an independent consultant implementing restorative practices in Northern California schools. On today's program, we'll discuss alternatives to policing, the school-to-prison pipeline, and what we can do to heal our communities. Stay with us.
Crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies like an ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, alternatives to policing, putting the power and money back into our communities and schools. We're joined by two amazing guests. Amber Yang is the author of a recent article on alternatives to policing, The Case for Public Health and Community Development Investments. That's at projectcensored.org, so we'll be referring to that throughout the hour. You can view it there. Amber Yang is the Restorative Justice and Wellness Coordinator for Novato High School, where she works to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline through conflict resolution circles, community-building circles, and youth-led community projects as alternatives to punitive discipline. Amber is a health educator and advocate for youth specializing in stress management and relaxation skills, healthy communication tools, and trauma-informed strategies to address social, emotional needs of all youth. Amber has written numerous articles with Project Censored and co-created a journalism model with Ken Burrows and Bethany Surface called The Constructive News and the Mindful Media Movement, which foregrounds solutions, community empowerment, positive storytelling, and the common good. That article, by the way, is a chapter in our recent Censored 2020 book. Amber Yang is currently pursuing a graduate degree at Sonoma State University in organizational change and development, and she has been a guest with us before. Amber Yang, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks, Mickey. It's really nice to be here.
It's always a delight to have you on, and your recent article is a really must-read, such a timely piece. We'll be talking about it during the show. And we're also joined by Phoebe Smith. Phoebe is a veteran teacher of 18 years, K through 8, and a facilitator of special curricula related to health education, community building, restorative practices, student leadership, and character building. She is a certified teacher trainer through the California BTSA program. Phoebe's also a certified mediator through Community Boards San Francisco and the SEEDS organization of Berkeley. She is the lead restorative practices specialist for Novato Unified, that's in Northern California in Marin County. Phoebe has earned a master's in public health, community organization, and a master's in education curriculum development. For the past 3 years, she has worked as an independent consultant implementing the restorative practices model in districts and schools in Novato, Berkeley, and Oakland, California, as well as guiding staff, students, and family through the restorative practices process. Phoebe Smith, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mickey.
Absolutely. It's a delight. And I know between the two of you, we're going to fill the hour with a lot of amazing and empowering information. And having spoken with you all prior to the show, we have a plan. Just want to let our listeners know that Amber's going to talk about alternatives to policing here in the beginning, putting the power and money back into communities. And then we'll hear from Phoebe on the school-to-prison pipeline, restorative justice, as an alternative to school policing for the first part of the show today. In the second part of the show, we'll go back. Again, we'll do the back and forth between Amber and Phoebe, but we'll be talking about case studies of students that they've worked with, and we'll hear some closing statements about what needs to be healed. So, Amber Yang, let's kick things off with you. Reminder, Alternatives to Policing, The Case for Public Health and Community Development Investments is your recent piece, June 11th, projectcensored.org. Let's open it up to you about the Alternatives to Policing story, Amber Yang.
As a restorative justice specialist at a high school, I constantly kept seeing the use of our school resource officer and how it wasn't really leading to real change when students would create harm in a school community. And it had me really questioning, you know, what is the role of police and how can we effectively create change and keep our schools safe and our streets safe? And is policing really the only option? So just doing restorative justice work at Novato High School, it's been a really interesting process that way. And this story really is not necessarily about the defund the police movement. And yet to defund the police, to even understand what that means, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, that means we must take a systemic look at the history of policing and the system that policing operates in, and really getting clear of where those funds will go if we are to defund the police and reallocate those funds. And I'll get to that shortly. But right now, most cities spend more on policing than on health, housing, arts, parks, community development, workforce development, and civil rights combined. So we also have about $5 billion worth of military hardware being sent to 8,000 police departments. So the question comes up, have cities become any safer with so much investment in policing? And here are some ways that I've answered that question in the article. So in 2016, Baltimore had the second deadliest year per capita on record with 318 killings. In a report that same year from the U.S. Department of Justice found that the Baltimore Police Department engaged in massive discriminatory policing, including unnecessary force, unjustified stops, and disproportionate targeting of blacks. So in 2017, officers in the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force were indicted on federal racketeering charges for massive abuses of power, including robbing people, drug dealing, clocking overtime when they weren't working, and also carrying toy guns as fake evidence if they killed unarmed people. Other examples include the New York Street Crimes Unit, which had to be shut down after a hail of 41 bullets from officers killed an unarmed West African immigrant by accident. And their unofficial unit slogan was, "We own the night." Last example I put in the article is CRASH, which stands for Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, which was actually the anti-gang unit of the Los Angeles Police Department, which eventually became the heart of a corruption scandal that involved excessive violence, cocaine theft, coercing confessions. So it really wouldn't surprise us that nearly 100 convictions have been overturned as a result of this scandal. So why does this happen? Well, my story considers how governments around the world have actually extended the discourse of war beyond the context of military hostilities traditionally understood. So in 1964, U.S. President Lyndon Johnson announced a war on poverty. In 1971, Richard Nixon called drug abuse public enemy number one and declared a war on drugs. And we saw in 2001, George W. Bush declaring a global war on terror in response to the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center. And now in 2020, we're right in the midst of this so-called war on COVID-19, which is a framing that we see a lot in mainstream media. And that really directs our attention not to science and humanitarianism and the common good, but really towards division, fear, and security-based force. So another thing to consider is that while some have labeled Black Lives Matter protesters as violent looters, what often the mainstream media isn't covering much of is that the violence often comes from police themselves, including agent provocateurs who actually instigate violence and instigate the looting and destruction of property, and other police tactics that suppress and defame demonstrations, often with rubber bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades, even with children present. And also, we have a lot of interesting information about police targeting journalists who are trying to cover the protests. So sociologist Alex Vitali, I cite him a lot in my article. He's the coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. And he says it in such an eloquent way. He says, when our elected officials ask police to wage simultaneous wars on drugs, gangs, disorder, terror, and crime, police will often be discourteous and aggressive. They will continue to violate people's rights and use excessive and militaristic force because that is how wars are waged. And it's also built into the deep history of American policing to be a tool for criminalizing people of color. So when we reflect on officer training, officers are trained to cultivate this warrior and militaristic mindset, such as what we shared above. And what this does is that it fuels unnecessary killings of people falsely considered a threat. Consider 12-year-old Tamir Rice, killed for holding a toy gun in an Ohio park. And a former police officer shares in an article for Yes Magazine that police are really trained to come into every situation imagining that it may be their last. And they treat those they encounter with fear and hostility and attempt to control them rather than communicate with them. And so they're much quicker to use force at the slightest provocation or even uncertainty. So to pause and say that we're not talking about not funding police at all. We're not anti-police. We're just examining the possibility of police reform to reallocate funds. So we still will have police no matter what. We still honor what they can do in emergency situations where 911 really is the only answer. Yet to reallocate funds, that doesn't mean that thugs are in charge, like Tucker Carlson said on Fox News the other night, or that we're getting rid of the police, like many people on the right are saying. It's actually about taking a critical look at the history of policing and how policing has time and time again violated the rights of lower-income communities and people of color because of the system that policing has operated in. It's also about decentralizing power through reallocating those funds so that city funding is more equitable and that communities can actually begin to build the resources they need to solve their own problems through investing in strategic public health and community development strategies. It's also about a deep systems thinking shift in which we address the root causes that motivate people to do crimes in which police are needed. So a mountain of sociological studies on wealth inequality has shown that wealth inequality has a corrosive effect on social cohesion. With the more unequal a society gets, the less likely people are to feel a sense of belonging and to see themselves as participants in a community, which can often lead to crime. In the school setting, there's also a study by the Centers for Disease Control that show a student's sense of belonging is a top protective factor against violence, incarceration, and drug abuse. So who likely feels that they don't belong? Well, people of color, LGBTQ, trans and non-binary people. And why don't they belong? What policies, ideologies, and perspectives keep us from seeing the humanity of others who are different than us? So that's the other thing. And then one other thing is coming to terms with the fact that police might not be the most helpful when someone is having a mental health crisis or is under the influence or having an overdose. So when we reflect on our dependence of police to provide safety, we must consider, how do we define safety? And whom do we feel threatened by and why? Police in cities arrest more people for drug offenses than for other crimes, with possession accounting for the vast majority of cases rather than manufacture or sales. So when we jail people for using drugs, that only reinforces the stigma and that only drags people in need of help into the shadows and actually fails to address, once again, the root causes, which are often associated with mental health challenges and socioeconomic needs that aren't met. 2017 UN report stated that mental health policies and services are in crisis, not a crisis of chemical imbalances, but of power imbalances, in which decision-making is controlled by biomedical gatekeepers whose outdated methods actually perpetuate stigma and discrimination. So instead of providing more comprehensive mental health and drug abuse services, we pour money into law enforcement. We have more police on the duty. We criminalize challenging behavior. And then we train police on how to kill fewer people in these interactions. So as sociologist Alex Vitale says, people with mental illnesses are seen not as victims of the neoliberal restructuring of public health services, but as a dangerous source of disorder to be controlled through intensive and aggressive policing. And I will say that not all police departments are criminalizing people that are having issues with drugs. There's a Project Censored story I wrote back in 2017 about police departments actually adopting a program that helps drug addicts versus jailing them, and that the program was so effective that 200 police departments adopted it, in which people struggling with addiction can actually walk into a police department and get treatment within hours. So this puts police in the life-saving business instead of the spin-drying business of arresting and releasing. So instead of utilizing police as the primary tool for managing symptoms of socioeconomic and race inequality, we must look at rebuilding and empowering our communities to actually address the root causes for real change. So to me, the defund police movement is less about targeting police departments, less about defunding, and more about reallocating the funds and to reinvest in community and the public good. That was all I wanted to say about the problem, and I wanted to move into the solutions after that.
I'd like to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, the host. We're speaking right now with Amber Yang. She's the Restorative Justice and Wellness Coordinator for Novato High School. She's author of a recent piece for Project Censored. It's on our website at projectcensored.org, Alternatives to Policing. After this break, we'll continue our conversation with Amber Yang and Phoebe Smith. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, alternatives to policing, putting the power and money back into communities and schools. We are speaking now with Amber Yang, Restorative Justice and Wellness Coordinator for Novato High School in Northern California, Marin County, where she works to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline through conflict resolution circles, community building circles, and youth-led community projects as alternatives to punitive discipline. She also co-authored a chapter with Ken Burrows and Bethany Surface in the new Project Censored book, Censored 2020, Through the Looking Glass, titled Our Collective Crisis in Constructive Journalism, Growing the Good and Possible. Amber Yang was speaking before the break, and she's going to continue to talk about some solutions to the problems that she outlined for us. And in a little bit, we'll be joined by Phoebe Smith, a veteran teacher, also works in the Novato school system, but has also worked in Berkeley and Oakland, California. So we're definitely going to be hearing more from Phoebe as we move through the program. Amber Yang, go ahead and continue. You are on a roll deconstructing a lot of the challenges we face, some of the language around it, because that's a really big thing. It's a really big challenge because for a lot of people, they don't see the police as militarized. So Amber Yang, go ahead and talk some more about the solutions that you propose.
That's great that you mentioned that, Mickey, because I also agree with you that with this whole defund police movement happening now, there's many people, especially on the right, really coming out and saying, what? The police are here for us. Where would we be without the police? Are we going to get rid of police? And so once again, and what I said earlier, it's really not about anti-policing. It's not about letting go of all policing. It's not about letting thugs take control, like Tucker Carlson says. It's really about reallocating our funds and making sure that the community also gets to solve their own problems and build the resources they need. So we're really talking about decentralizing the power as well. And like many problems, what often isn't covered in corporate media and independent press is actually what is already happening to really solve these problems. So right now we have huge movements like the Defund the Police movement that's mainly problem focused. And so part of my story also talks about, well, what communities, what real examples are already out there for people to actually sink their teeth into and believe that there's a narrative beyond policing where communities are helping keep their streets safe? So the second part of my article is really the fact that we need public health interventions and strategic community investments to build community strength from the ground up. And what this also means is that we're also directly addressing root causes that create crime, that instead of managing crime, we're actually working to address the root causes of crime. So we might not even need excessive policing in the first place. One example is the Oakland Power Project, which aims to reject police and policing as the default response to harm and to highlight or create alternatives that actually work by identifying current harms, amplifying existing resources, and developing new practices that don't rely on policing solutions. So in the project's Know Your Options workshops, community street medics and healthcare workers of all backgrounds build skills and knowledge around preventative care, emergency skills, and mental health and de-escalation tactics. And this is one of my favorites, Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets, which stands for CAHOOTS. It's funded by the Whiteburn Clinic in Eugene, Oregon. And basically what CAHOOTS is, it's a mobile crisis intervention service that shares a central dispatch with the Eugene Police Department, and it's fully funded by this Eugene's Public Safety Services. So every day from 11 a.m. to 3 a.m., the CAHOOTS van provides free first response services, including non-emergency medical care, basic first aid, mental crisis intervention, counseling, mediation, transportation, case assessment, even referral and advocacy. And CAHOOTS workers actually estimate they save the Eugene Police Department over $4.5 million annually, and they save more than $1 million more in medical expenses. So I'm thinking about a lot of EMTs, emergency medical technicians, coming out and saying there's so many people that are afraid to call 911 with the problem they have based on how police respond in situations. And so having these alternatives can be powerful, powerful ways for communities to help each other versus criminalizing people for what they're doing. Also, there's a nonprofit called Safe Streets Baltimore, which utilizes credible messenger strategies where adults from the community, history of street involvement, actually help steer youth into pro-social activities, as well as addressing neighborhood violence by providing trauma counseling and street mediation. Another example is part of what we'll be talking about later, but it's really the need for restorative practices and restorative justice in schools. And we'll be talking about that more with me and Phoebe, who will be sharing more in a little bit. But basically, restorative justice is a harm reduction approach that developed out of indigenous peacemaking practices, and it's actually proven to be very highly effective in school settings. So what it often does is it uses cooperative processes to hold people who have done harm accountable and to actually support them in the transformation of their own behavior, often with the direct involvement of people whom harm was done to. So oftentimes when you look at the criminal justice system, people who have harmed, all the focus gets to be on them, and then punishment happens for them. What about the person that experienced the harm? Where is that process, right? So restorative justice really takes a holistic approach. And so it also addresses that turning school discipline over to police invariably results in more suspensions, expulsions, and arrests directed at our most high-needs youth. So when we think about in a school setting, what would it be like for restorative justice programs that involve meaningful community service to come through? Trauma-informed wellness strategies, conflict resolution circles, more counselors, social workers, after-school programs, those would be powerful alternatives than to have a police presence on campus. So as parts of the country like LA are identifying cuts in its police department, the next and last question is, where does this funding go to then if we are to identify cuts in police departments? Well, in my article, I talk about how cities could actually establish those funds to provide employment, invest in affordable housing and schools, and increase access to social services that help people get their basic needs met. And also investing in community land trusts and cooperatives that actually help create housing equity by decentralizing housing development and ownership. And there's a great story that just got released by Xavier Rosenberg of SF State as well. In 2019, 117 rights groups released Vision for Justice 2020, which is basically an expanded holistic framework to transform the U.S. criminal legal system by actually prioritizing upfront investments in non-carceral programs and social services. It's a great story. You can check it out at projectcensored.org. Funds could also go to clean air and water, green spaces, walkable neighborhoods, lively public spaces, vital social institutions, and other avenues for public engagement, where public engagement is a basic ingredient for belonging and well-being. Vitaly, who I've mentioned before, also expressed another way to reinvest funds. He talked about how neighborhoods where problematic behavior is highly concentrated, how local and state officials spend millions of dollars to police and incarcerate people. Well, he poses the question, what if those communities actually kept some percentage of people who get arrested in the community and tried to develop strategies for resolving their problems, and in return, the community got the money that would have been spent incarcerating them? So when we empower and resource our communities to resolve situations and conflicts on their own, we actually help repair the social fabric frayed by division, diminished human and civil rights, racism, socioeconomic inequality, and the centralization of power with minimal or no police intervention. So as Vitaly eloquently states, once again, the very nature of policing and the law is to be a tool for managing inequality and maintaining the status quo. So we need real alternatives to systemically address the root causes and solutions of violence and inequality, while also actively working to build a shared narrative of collaboration and community empowerment, mutual compassion, and human goodness. And I believe that the police departments and policing can be a part of it, but they shouldn't be the only part of it. We really should be empowering our communities more. So that's what my story is about.
And an excellent story that needs the telling. And you've done a fantastic job with this piece. It's up at projectcensored.org. Alternatives to Policing, the Case for Public Health and Community Development Investments. A number of stories that we've done at Project Censored over the years on police brutality and the prison industrial complex. We're putting together a reader with our publisher, an e-reader from Seven Stories Press that should be out shortly. So we'll certainly be sharing that via projectcensored.org. One of those stories was the 8 use of force policies to prevent killings by police. And a number of years ago, San Francisco State student Malcolm Pinson helped research that story with Ken Burrows from Yes Magazine. And we had that up and did a video project around that. So we've been covering these issues for a while, so it's good to see that there's finally more momentum societally across the spectrum where we need to address these issues. Phoebe Smith, I want to bring you into the conversation. Just to remind our listeners, Phoebe Smith's a veteran teacher of 18 years and a facilitator of special curricula related to health education, community building, and restorative practices, student leadership. She's a certified teacher trainer. You have 2 graduate degrees, public health, community organization, and education, also curriculum development. And for the past 3 years, you've been working as an independent consultant implementing the restorative practices model in school districts in Novato, Berkeley, and Oakland, as well as guiding staff, students, and family through the restorative practices process. Phoebe Smith, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And I was just saying, as I was listening and I read Amber's wonderfully written article, just about how she connected these 2 ideas with one another and really grounded the idea of what can be done with the funds that would be redirected, redistributed throughout the community. Just imagine if we were able to redirect funds to restorative practices such that on every campus, schools have a full-time restorative practices specialist. Both Amber and I work on the school campuses, but I work at several of the schools by myself, the middle schools and the elementary schools, which we have 11 of total. And Amber works at the high school, and we have another restorative practices specialist that works at the other 2 high schools. And what would that look like if we were able to redirect funds, which is where eventually we want to go with restorative practices, where we will have a restorative practices specialist on every campus. And I'll explain what we do and let our audience try on how restorative practice response might look on their school campuses within their school districts. A little bit different from, say, having a counselor on the school campus. We work in tandem with counselors for sure around the whole mental health wellness issue, social emotional learning component for students. But restorative practices offers a little different feel to the process in which we're dealing with the social emotional learning components that students are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And so the restorative practices model itself has 2 prongs to it. On one side, which is the truly the foundation, the basis of restorative practices, consists of community building, classroom dynamics. I personally go into classrooms and support teachers, modeling restorative practices circles, sparking dialogue with students, talking about social justice issues, and doing conflict resolution as a preventive measure. And then the other side of the restorative practices model looks at conflict resolution for all community members, from administrators, staff, students, other staff on campus, parents, community partners. So we bring all of those people together as well to have conversations. We do conversation cafes, which basically puts out a social justice issue of some type or an issue that concerns the community. And then we, all of those partners, come together and basically have conversations around those things. And so giving students the opportunity and the space to come together and have these conversations is a preventative measure that helps the community get to know each other better, to accept each other's differences and perspectives and so forth. That's one part of it. And then the other part of it is the conflict resolution or harm circles that we do. This is doing something alternative to the traditional disciplinary action that's usually taken for students. We actually give students the opportunity to sit down with the person that they might have had an incident with. The other arm of it is the harm circles and conflict resolution, where we actually bring all parties of an incident together so they can talk out an issue that they have come to. They come to their own resolution, and then they actually engage with one another in a restorative plan that will help not just resolve the issue, but build back the community and also find a way to reintroduce a person who has offended the community at large, or someone in particular, reintroduce them back into the community in a way where everyone acknowledges that harm has been done, it's been healed, we're in the process of healing, we've forgiven, and moving forward, and therefore allowing the community to grow in closeness and bond with one another. So that's basically the model in and of itself. Restorative practices was introduced into the school setting as a result of a state Senate bill, Senate Bill 419. And basically what's noted was that disproportionately students of color were being disciplined in more extreme ways than other students. And as well, they were being disciplined at a higher rate. And actually, to support that, we have data from 2017 report on American education, race, and school suspensions. And they reported that African-American students are 3 times more likely to get suspended from school than Latinos, 4 times more likely than Caucasian, and 7 times more likely than Asian students. And those statistics have pretty much maintained at that rate over time. All the suspension rates, I might mention, have declined over the last 3 years, which is great, in large part due to programs like restorative practices and other behavioral support programs. But what I think happens a lot of the time in schools and within our academic system that, of course, has systemic racism built into it, is that over time, students and the administrators and teachers at schools, I think that underlyingly there's a mistrust on both sides. We're dealing from a deficit when we're interacting with each other from the beginning. Biases toward Black students is exhibited in cases like random behaviors or frequent behaviors from all students, but those behaviors are viewed as violent or threatening when displayed by Black students. For example, a lot of the referrals that we'll get are for horseplay, and we're at middle school a lot and high school. And especially in middle school, you notice that there's a lot of horseplay. Like, kids cannot keep their hands off of each other, right? You see this all the time. However, in more cases than not, African American students or Latino students are written up on referral for horseplay versus very little referrals for white students for horseplay. And also, under the traditional arm of discipline, the consequences that those students of color receive for horseplay are a lot more significant and severe than white students or students of other races. And so these are something that we actively see on campuses on a day-to-day basis. And these are the cases that we are actually called to support students in to provide restorative practices on a very frequent basis. Another reason why I think that a lot of this disparity occurs is because of the cultural differences and distinctions that certain students exhibit are not acceptable in the mainstream academic system. And then the systemic racism is inherent in terms of trauma. So like there are a lot of students of color who actually have trauma from outside of school, not just in school, but outside of school. And so they bring that to school too, of course. And so that expression of that trauma, you're going to have those students, and it comes from the systemic racism that they're experiencing outside of school and in school. Those are some things that I've identified as being contributing factors as to why disproportionately students of color and specifically African-American students get a negative consequence such as a suspension or expulsion from school for their behaviors. This year, we've been working with an organization, SEEDS organization out of Berkeley, and they've been doing really great work with us in supporting staff to be more culturally responsive with students, as well as changing our language, being more supportive and more empathetic towards students, de-escalation strategies, and learning ways of looking at our own personal triggers and trying to break down our bias around various students. And it may not necessarily be, in this case, students of color, but we all have bias, right? And so we look at what our triggers are. We find out that, oh, maybe I'm triggered by this because of these bias. So the SEEDS organization introduced a great model to us that shows basically how it occurs that students are moved from your traditional academic institution into the prison, the pipeline system. And it really begins with like really micro managing occurrences, like in class, someone's talking too much, someone's yelling out, someone might even be being disrespectful to other students or to the teacher. And that leads to a series of common steps that teachers will take. And Steve basically puts it to say that, you know, when we take those traditional steps, instead of checking in with the student, learning more about the student, bonding with the student, engaging with the student in a way that's de-escalating instead of escalating, if you take all of those steps, then you basically are moving away from the traditional line of steps that you would normally take traditionally that actually has proven to lead students, and primarily students of color, from your academic setting to prison. And so it starts with things like in-school isolation. So I'm a teacher, and you have a student who won't stop talking, and you basically decide to take them out of their table group and move them to the corner or to the front of the classroom where they're sitting by themselves. That's in-school or in-class isolation or in-classroom separation. And a lot of teachers feel like, what else can I do with this student? Like, I've reached out to their parents. I've talked to them several times. You tell them several times as a warning, I'm going to have to move you out of your group. You have those conversations with the student, all of that being very accusatory, judgmental, and punitive versus really digging in to find out what's going on with the student. What does the student want to say? What space can I create for this student so that they do feel heard instead of just looking at them as a disruption? That small thing leads into being sent out of the classroom entirely. It leads to a referral. It leads to being suspended, even possibly if you've been sent up enough times, because now you're just being seen as disrespectful. And then if you get written enough times and have enough suspensions, then you might even go to an expulsion review board. So this is something that systematically and continually happens to our students of color, primarily over time, and they call it the continuum of disengagement. And basically, relationally, kids are all about relationships, their relational energy. And so if they don't feel like you're connecting with them, then they don't have any stake in that relationship. And then you don't get out of them what you need. And so that's why we really promote it to teachers to really take the time, primarily through community circles, to get to know their students. It's not even like taking time out to individually have a conversation with a particular student. It really is just coming together as a community, including everyone, and hearing from everyone. And that's how you get to know your students. So that's our model. That's what we do. And I really enjoy doing the work that I am doing. One big part of my leaving the classroom in the first place was because I started to do this in my own classroom and saw such a great need from my students, saw them responding so positively to our community circle gatherings or our classroom meetings, in which they got the opportunity to get to know each other and bond and argue and heal and bring up issues that were important to them, become activists on campus, and really deciding that this is where I want to put all of my time and not have to be held to all of the standards and responsibilities that the teachers are held responsible for in terms of the curriculum and so many other things. And so I'm so glad that I happened upon doing this work full time, and it's just been a blessing.
Phoebe Smith, thanks so much for packing so much information into such a short space. Definitely have a wealth of experience basically at your fingertips and on the tip of your tongue. We've been speaking with Amber Yang and Phoebe Smith. Today's program is about alternatives to policing, putting the power and money back into our communities and schools. This is the Project Censored Show, Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. After this brief musical break, we're going to continue with Phoebe Smith and Amber Yang. They're going to share some case studies of students that they've worked with as examples. And of course, we'll round out the program today with Phoebe and Amber talking about what needs to be healed. So please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we've been talking about alternatives to policing, putting the power and money back into our communities and schools. What does it mean to defund the police? Well, we've been learning all about that, and we've also been learning about the school-to-prison pipeline and restorative justice as an alternative to school policing. Our guests today are Amber Yang, the Restorative Justice and Wellness Coordinator for Novato High School, and also Phoebe Smith, a veteran teacher. Also, for the last 3 years, she has worked as an independent consultant implementing the restorative practices model in districts and schools in Novato, Berkeley, and Oakland in Northern California. Before the break, Phoebe Smith, you were talking about the work that you do, and you and Amber wanted to share some case studies, put the human face on this, so to speak. I mean, obviously, you're not going to use names, but it really helps when you tell the story of the people that you get to work with.
This year in our district, we decided as a team or a restorative practices specialist to choose a student or two that we could highlight. We call them our profiles in courage because, in fact, we're working with students who are dealing with trauma, and the restorative practices model is a vehicle that allows us to explore that. And so we are supposed to work with the students in this window of time for community building. So that can be over time, but not specific to any particular student. And then the harm circle side, where something has actually taken place, some offense has been made, and we are trying to heal it or correct the harm that's been done. And so on that side of it, what we're trying to do is work with students in a small period of time where we meet with them, they do the discussion, and then they do a restorative plan where they work together in some form or fashion to heal the harm that's been done. And so normally that should be it, but we end up working with a lot of students over time because they are students who are experiencing trauma, and they find that they can come to our space and have conversations with other students all through this restorative circle talks format. And we get to learn and dive deeper into students' lives on many occasions. And so we've chosen to pick a few students to actually have as our profiles in courage because really them being at school every day is an achievement. And then trying to perform and stay successful and stay on at the same level as everyone else who's not dealing with the same situation that they're dealing with, you know, it's a whole nother thing. So these students, we have noticed that with the intervention of restorative practices, that they've actually made a shift. And so we want to really hone in and focus in on what that actually looked like, because you have basically two paths in which they could go. One is the traditional path that I described earlier, where there's disengagement and this pipeline to prison route. And then there is the restorative practices path, where with this intervention, something different occurs for these students. And so Amber is going to share her profile in courage this year to highlight how the intervention impacted the student's life.
This profile in courage has been actually one of the most memorable experiences of my first year here at the high school I work at. My student is a Native American 16-year-old male, and I won't mention any names. Basically, I started working with this young male when there was an incident of him and his brother getting into a physical altercation with another male student outside of the bathroom. And at this point, when I heard about it, Novato Police Department had already contacted and cited him for battery on school grounds. And the administration at my school wanted me to work with him to have a restorative circle. And I think in some ways, sometimes people see restorative circle as a Band-Aid, and it's not. So to me, when I got this case, I was really curious about getting to know who this student was and why it happened versus immediately addressing the harm. And just to pause and say that this male I work with, what he did was he knocked a student to the ground after already being punched. And so what he got in his record was used force and violence, 2-day suspension, and battery on school ground citation from the Novato Police Department. Well, what's interesting is I also worked with a Caucasian student on a different basis who pushed a student over the railing, and this student got disruption of school activities with a 2-day suspension. So to me, what Phoebe was talking about happens when I work with these kids. I mean, here you have a student engaging in 10 punches, pushing a student over the rail and gets disruption of school activities. And then the student I work with pushes a student to the ground after being punched and he gets used force and violence and battery on school ground citation. So we really start questioning, why are these different? And so back to this story about this boy, I began to build a relationship with this boy. And what I found was that this young male had witnessed countless traumatizing acts of violence in the home. His father in particular had been involved in gang activity. So when you grow up with violence and with parents struggling with alcoholism and drug addiction, you're not going to get a student coming to school meeting all the expectations that teachers and staff want. You're going to get a student who literally operates from a survival mindset, where learning how to do math is the last thing on his mind. He just wants to feel safe. So this is the basic understanding from a trauma-informed approach, to really take a social-emotional approach to understand our students, with the idea that when you address the social-emotional needs, then you can really address the academic needs. So at this point, I also found that he was in danger of failing all of his classes, and he had poor attendance at 65%, which is basically barely here. And what I also found was that this young male is incredibly thoughtful and insightful and had these meaningful dreams of owning a home and helping create a loving family. And this was after a few times of talking to him and building relationships. So here's a student that staff members not just saw as a danger, which I often heard from his teachers, but oftentimes treated him as if he didn't exist. And he often reported telling me that he felt invisible, like no one really sees him. And he and I would often quote the words from Tupac on The Rose That Grew from the Concrete. So it goes like, you try to plant something in the concrete, and if it grows and all the rose petals got all kind of scratches and marks, you're not going to say, dang, look at all those scratches and marks on the rose that grew from the concrete. You're going to say, dang, a rose grew from the concrete? So same thing with me. So he and I would often recite that, just laughing together. And we started building a really meaningful connection. And just like many, many, many students I work with, what you see is not what you think it is. When you get to know every single student, you realize their unique potential, their capacity to learn and be meaningful, participative citizens if we allow the space and the switch for them to do so. And so he and I started building a nice relationship that way. And basically, one of the principals at our school had him on his caseload and really wanted him to participate in the expulsion process, where he would go to county community school when he saw his record with low attendance and tendency to get into fights and not doing well in all his classes. His brother was actually brought up on the disciplinary action in the expulsion process. And my student went to support him because he's his brother. And turns out at the review board, they actually decided for my student that he would go in the expulsion process too without any real due process. So I began to have fierce restorative practices advocacy with the school psychologist on site, with his counselor, and with Phoebe. And we were able to keep him here at Novato High School to prove that he can actually do it. And so we created a comprehensive plan where I began meeting weekly with him, mentoring him on social emotional issues, drug education, and began doing meditations with him and helping him get clear of the roots of violence and anger with himself. So a lot of students, we do community service projects. With him, it was more about really going internal and understanding the traumas and the angers that he held inside. And I'm so touched to say that in a month, just a month, his attendance rate went from 65% to 95%, and he had all A's and B's and one C. And what's most important, above all, above the attendance rate and the grades, is that he looked me in the eye and had this big smile on his face and said, this is the first time he ever felt motivated to go to school.
That's an amazing story, Amber.
And I just want to add, got a little emotional there because I'm really just feeling how real it was, that this is not just some local singular event. This happens all the time with the students I work with when they get the opportunity to be seen and be heard for the struggles they go through every day. That was my profile in Courage. And my hope is that we create a school system that really allows for that. Like Phoebe, what you said, the restorative circles in classrooms, community building circles.
Amber Yang, thank you very much for sharing that with us. And also, Phoebe Smith, thank you. We have very little time left. There's been so much information this hour. We're very grateful to have Amber Yang and Phoebe Smith with us. Maybe share some places where people can follow your work or contact you. I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that you all are interested in doing workshops and other kinds of trainings, and it would be great if you could share a few of your thoughts on what needs to be healed here.
That's a question out there right now. Like, what can we do to heal, especially now with all of the social unrest that we're experiencing? And, you know, we both agree that education and humility are key. Educating mm-hmm. ourselves individually. And then the biggest thing to me that just touched me so much when Amber and I were talking was just the idea of humility. In order to get vulnerable and be authentic with what you're thinking and feeling and how what you're thinking and feeling and who you're being is impacting the people who you come into contact with. In order to really be vulnerable, that you have to bring yourself to a place of humility. And in being humble enough to allow other people to be heard, allowing students who have been disenfranchised to actually tell their stories and to tell their side of things. And we all have to be humble enough to do that. I hate watching Judge Judy because she doesn't let people just like say their story, right? She just already knows what happened. And it's like, why are we here if you already know what happened? I feel the same way a lot of times some students feel, that they're just sitting in the office, letting the principal just talk at them. You know, a lot of times we'll have our students come and tell us their story. And then we'll say, did you tell that to the principal? And they'll be like, no. Why? Well, their lived experience in being in the office talking to an adult isn't positive, and it's not a place where they feel like they can be heard. And, of course, it's not across the board. Just like with Amber's story and defunding the police, we don't want to vilify administrators, police, or anyone. We're just suggesting looking at engaging with people in a different way. And becoming aware of how to do that and how we don't do that now. And we have to be humble enough to be able to do that. I'd be glad to speak with anyone in the audience. You can reach out to me personally at phoebesmith70@gmail.com. It's phoebesmith70@gmail.com. We have a restorative practices website on our NUSD.org page under Healthy Novato. And we also have a Instagram page, which is NUSDRP and TUPE. Nikki, it was really great to share with your audience the work that we're doing and how all of what we're going through right now connects with some of the things that we already have in place and that we're already in motion doing. So I'm really glad to have had the opportunity to bring voice to it also today.
Phoebe Smith, thank you so much. It's an honor to have you on. Such an important topic, and it's fantastic to have such amazing, empathetic experts in this area of education that's so sorely needed, both in and outside of the school. So Phoebe Smith, the honor and pleasure is certainly mine. Amber Yang, where can we find you, and what do you think needs healed?
To me, the story I wrote and the work I do with Restorative Practices and Justice with Phoebe is all about taking action for what do we want? What do we want? What are we for? We're not just for police accountability and police defunding. We're also for community empowerment and collaboration and human goodness. And building that narrative is huge. And so I would even add that we should teach students cultural humility even before we introduce privilege. So to me, humility is really the bridge to understanding our privilege. So when we walk around, what does humility, cultural humility, behaviorally look like, physically look like, socially look like, in all the settings we're a part of? And so really, when we start off with what we're for, I think we can really begin to create change and celebrate our differences. So I want to end with just a quote by Julia Butterfly Hill, and it goes like this. So often activism is based on what we are against and what we don't like and what we don't want. And yet we manifest what we focus on. So we are manifesting yet ever more of what we don't want, what we don't like, and what we want to change. So for me, activism is about a spiritual practice of the way of life. And I realized I didn't climb the tree because I was angry at the corporations and the government. I climbed the tree because when I fell in love with the redwoods, I fell in love with the world. So it is my feeling of connection that drives me instead of my anger and feelings of being disconnected. Thank you, Julia Butterfly Hill, for that lovely quote. And I'll end there.
Hear, hear, Amber Yang. It's a very high note to end on. Amber Yang, Phoebe Smith, thank you so much for the work you do Amber, your latest piece is up at projectcensored.org, Alternatives to Policing, the Case for Public Health and Community Development Investments. Phoebe and Amber, again, thanks so much. Be well, and I'm sure we'll cross paths again soon.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.